This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KPMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you too. 2 p.m. Regular listeners may remember that several months ago I talked with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam about a book he has been working on for the past year on the Great Books program. He's been working on it, as I said, for about a year. He's got about a year and a half to go, and we're going to check in with him several times in that time to find out how he's doing. First time we talked, we got a vague overview of what he had in mind and how he was going about it. When I talked to him more recently, he was so enthusiastic and so full of information that I realized it would fill an entire program rather than just half as I had originally intended. So we're going to hear him in two segments this afternoon. The first one runs through the history of the academic history of the Great Books Program, how it got started at Columbia and then got transferred to the University of Chicago and finally to St. John's College. In the second half, we'll talk about the equally fascinating commercial history of the Great Books Program, especially from the late 30s to about the early 60s. We start out now with Alex Beam telling us a bit about how he first heard about the Great Books Program and how it first developed.
I came to the subject of the Great Books in a very circuitous way. I write a column for the Boston Globe, and a reader asked me if I had ever heard of a business entity called Liberal Arts Incorporated, which sounded sort of strange and counterintuitive just going in, and of course I had not. And to get to the point, Liberal Arts Incorporated was a business formed, of all things, by Paul Mellon, the son of the famous Treasury Secretary, and himself an incredibly rich individual who once took a course on the Great Books at, I guess at St. John's College in 1938 or 1939. He actually didn't last a whole semester. And there was a threat. St. John's College is a famous Great Book school that we'll talk about in a separate context. And during the war, it looked like the Navy was going to take over the St. John's campus, which happens to be in Annapolis, directly adjacent to the Naval Academy. So Mellon, who was unbelievably rich, founded a business called Liberal Arts Incorporated and bought a huge estate next to the Stockbridge Bowl in Massachusetts. The Stockbridge Bowl is a curious New England euphemism for a lake. It's actually a fair-sized lake. And Mellon, spurred on by the so-called great bookies, Mortimer Adler, Robert Hutchins, and a few others, again, names that will become more familiar to us, invested, of all things, about $15 million. This is in 1939, back when that was actually quite a bit of money, to form this company, to buy this property that was eventually going to resettle the so-called Great Books College in Massachusetts. And I'm not from anywhere, frankly, where I ever would have heard about the Great Books. I had literally never heard about the Great Books. And this one tiny thread, it's sort of like the reverse of the story of the sweater. I mean, I picked up this tiny thread, which eventually led me to this rather beautifully woven tapestry, really, which was the Great Books movement in the 20th century in the United States.
So, but I assume since St. John's is still in Annapolis that the Stockbridge Bowl is not the home of another Great Books institution.
Yes, it's a completely ridiculous kind of footnote to the history of the great books. All these people panicked, thinking that the Navy was going to take them over, and somebody sort of got to the, it was all sort of a misunderstanding, really, and there's a bunch of letters to the Secretary of the Navy, and no, in fact, a large yoga retreat called Kripalu actually is on the site that Mellon had selected for the future Great Books University. And I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt because, in fact, at some point in the 60s, the St. John's became so successful that, you know, they started a second campus, not in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, but in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
So the Great Books program was already going in 1938. Somehow I thought it didn't start until the late 40s.
No, the real deep dish mainline Great Books got started immediately after World War I, when this kind of genteel, I would say almost classically a Columbia University academic named John Erskine, who came from a kind of comfortable background in New Jersey. He was sort of your very average, maybe better than average, engaging English professor at Columbia, who liked the classics and went, of all things, volunteered to join the American forces in World War I, and became involved in a really indescribably odd educational project pioneered by the French and the YMCA, where the doughboys and the poilus, as the French called them, would come to these, there's a specific French name for them, they're sort of like huts or places of retreat after they had finished a battle, and they would be read excerpts from the classics, Montaigne, Ronsard, Du Bellay, Victor Hugo. And Erskine was not there to fight. He was there really as part of an educational mission with the YMCA. And he helped organize this, these kind of sort of classical reading rest breaks for tired soldiers, who, and I mean, a lot of sardonic commentary accompanies this, because obviously tired soldiers might have perhaps appreciated, you know, a grog of rum or maybe an encounter with a young mademoiselle. But in any case, the YMCA was serving up the great books, as it were. And then in another, almost, I mean, I don't know how I'm going to write about this, because it sounds so foreign, almost like nothing we've ever heard. There was a problem after the armistice in November of 1918. We had a huge fighting force in Europe, and I'm so ignorant that I'll just guess that it was 500,000 men. And, you know, this wasn't the late 20th century. We didn't really have a way of getting those men back, and they were all 21, 22. Many of them had interrupted university careers to go fight with the American Army. So the American Army set up a one-year university in a city in France called Beaune, and John Erskine, who was known to the Army at the time, known to the for his activities with the YMCA, became president of what effectively was a provisional university in France, educating American soldiers in the English language. And it was a diverse, they taught them accounting, they had business methods, but they also fervidly taught the great books. And it instilled in this guy, Erskine, this very deep belief that young men, were not talking about women, nor were we talking about women at Columbia when he came back in 1920. He had this firm belief that the great works of literature, whatever you choose to call them, Homer, Plato, Plutarch, Augustine, Aquinas, up to the great 19th century novels, Locke, the great political writers, Sheridan, the great English dramatist, Shakespeare, of course, Milton. He felt that you could get 21-year-olds in a room, assign the text, and sit in essentially in a seminar situation. And he sort of designed this particular method of pedagogy, which was emulated first at Columbia and then later at Chicago, which was a round table seminar with two professors in the room. Erskine, it was always co-taught, and the only subject of discussion for 2 hours was the text. And as you know, I mean, this invokes echoes of other interesting critical approaches of the 20th century, the so-called New Criticism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Erskine was very anti-commentary, and which became again an integral part of the great book's pedagogy, which is it's just you read the Crito, you read the dialogue of Plato, all the men have read it, and in a way it's almost like group dynamic. It's almost like a psychological adventure. The professor is not necessarily the person who speaks first. It's a little bit, if you will, like the legal case study method, where the professor invites. You know, there's that famous scene from Paper Chase at Harvard Law School, where, you know, Mr. Clark, state the case. And in a way, that's what they did with the great books. They would invite one of the students to start talking. Well, what do you find important in Crito? What are the issues that Plato is laying before the reader? Never read a criticism. It's all about the text. It's all about bringing the students inside the text of the great book. And that's what Erskine brought back over tremendous resistance, by the way, by the Columbia faculty in the calendar teaching year, 1920. Erskine said, I want to start this course. It was called General Honors. It was for a relatively small group of seniors. And the faculty went berserk. It was because it was a total affront to the way the so-called modern American university was organized at the time, because, of course, there at Columbia, which was and remains obviously a completely top-tier university, you know, the Greek department wanted to teach Plato, and the philosophy department wanted to teach Plato. In other words, specialization had already set in the liberal arts. And so the whole issue of reading, just we'll keep with Plato as an example, of reading the classics in translation was hugely controversial, because Greek was still being routinely taught at universities and at the schools that prepared men for the universities. Greek and Latin were routinely taught. Yale was awash in Greek and Latin. It was, I think you needed it to graduate as late as like the late 1920s. So there's huge institutional resistance to Erskine saying, I'm going to take the Iliad, I'm going to find a good translation, I'm going to put it in the center of the table, and I say that these young men can have a spirited and informed discussion. Of course, he proved to be right. I mean, that's the point. But it was extremely a radical approach at the time. I mean, many, many ruffled feathers. And it wasn't exactly embraced by Columbia, although therein lies a tale.
Now, this is the same John Erskine who is a popular novelist writing sort of sardonic novels based on historical themes, like The Private Life of Helen of Troy?
Yes, absolutely.
So in a way, he brought the classics to the world in two different ways, through his somewhat comic novels, and which are also heavily philosophical, but in a comic way, and through the Great Books program.
Exactly, and I'm somewhat embarrassed at... The Private Life of Helen of Troy was a huge bestseller in, like, whenever it was published. Again, I'm not exactly clear, late 20s or 30s. And he followed it up. It was huge and lucrative. There is no biography of John Erskine. He's one of these kind of, I guess, beautiful relics you see by the wayside. And his life is just totally tantalizing in its possibilities. For instance, he left Columbia to become the president of Juilliard. I mean... How is that even imaginable? He was a very gifted pianist. How do I know? Probably not a concert pianist, but gifted enough that he was entrusted with the president of the Juilliard Institute. And then he left that, as you say, just basically to become a very successful novelist and writer. He was later dragged back. This is something I'll end up writing about. Once the Chicago gang seized and essentially sort of tried to monetize the Great Books movement, which again was essentially invented by Erskine. They tried to drag Erskine back, I think, to get some of his credibility and to sort of sneak under his mantle. And curiously, he never really associated himself with the much broader Chicago movement.
So who were the Chicago gang?
The Chicago gang really grew up, they were grad students under Erskine. Erskine taught general honors. He wanted good grad students to sit at the table with them, so, and practically all of them, or many of them, later became famous. One was a young grad student named Mortimer Adler. who was hanging around Columbia ticking people off, which was his stock in trade. I think he was nominally a PhD in philosophy. Famously, you know, wrote his PhD in 22 hours or something ridiculous. It was on music theory. Mark Van Doren, who at one point, you know, was viewed as sort of the poet laureate of the United States, was another one of his graduate students. And they actually, there was a curious moment where they were teaching the great books to workers at what was called the People's Institute in Manhattan. A kind of episode I don't have a lot of information about, and I'm somewhat embarrassed. I have to go down to the People's Institute archives. But in any case, it was really, there are a couple of other names that aren't that well known. Richard McCune, I believe, is the correct name, M-C-K-E-O-W-N.
Who translated quite a lot of the Greek philosophers.
Right. But Adler, an unbelievable kind of a concatenation of circumstances. Adler is, by all accounts, young, brilliant, and incredibly disputatious. And he hooks up with this guy, Robert Hutchins, who so far hasn't been part of this discussion, but Hutchins is this incredible wunderkind up at Yale Law School, who, of all things, is rewriting the textbook on evidence. And Adler has a serious philosophical background and wants to go up and help Hutchins do this book. And, you know, in effect, they fall in love in 1928. Robert Hutchins and Mortimer Adler simply fall in love. And inter alia, Adler says, well, I'm teaching the great books down at the People's Institute. We've been teaching them at Columbia. This is the way to go. And then, of course, lightning strikes. I mean, out of nowhere, a 29-year-old, brilliant, handsome, accomplished academic named Robert Hutchins is teleported, if you will. That's a modern terminology used in Second Life. He's teleported to become president of the University of Chicago. There have been two botched attempts to recruit a new president. And so, in a way, it's incredibly dramatic. You know, you have this great university founded by John D. Rockefeller. It's had already one astonishingly famous president. Now I'm embarrassed because it's not Nicholas Murray Butler. Jesus Christ, can you help me, Eric?
Butler was at Columbia, and I don't remember the other Chicago person.
Yeah, it was the first guy, and there's a couple of buildings named after him. And he was the guy Rockefeller chose. But then they had a kind of fallow period. In any case, I mean, Chicago was definitely poised for greatness. I mean, the idea throughout the 20th century, the way, interestingly, it was Stanford's mission also, was to stick it to the Ivy League geographically and to prove, as both Stanford and Chicago did, that you didn't have to go to this kind of narrow corridor, the East Coast, to get a truly world-class education. So they drafted Hutchins out of the Yale Law School, made him president of the University of Chicago, and really the first thing Hutchins did was bring in Adler. Adler brought in McEwen and a couple of other people from Columbia. And Adler had completely convinced Hutchins, who had attended, of all things, Oberlin, then Yale, and then Yale Law School. Adler convinced Hutchins that Hutchins himself was totally uneducated. And Hutchins wrote about this at the time, and he kept lecturing about it throughout his life, that he had gone to good universities and emerged a kind of stumble bum, the way, of course, as we know, you can do in our time. He felt, you know, he hadn't learned anything. So, to sort of encapsulate, virtually the first thing they did when they got to Chicago was they started to try to create a deep dish, full bore liberal arts curriculum that took 7 or 8 years. They experimented first on freshmen. Hutchins, the president himself, and Adler taught freshmen a kind of exact replica of Columbia's general honors course. A tremendous resistance within the academy at Chicago. And then they embarked on an even more ambitious, and I think in retrospect, almost illusory project, which was to create a 4-year general honors liberal arts curriculum, except that they were going to rope the students in the 11th grade. So the idea was they were going to create a grade 11 through sophomore year, 4-year liberal arts curriculum that would carry boys and girls, you know, up through their sophomore years at the University of Chicago with again, and exclusively great books as the reading material, taught exclusively in the seminar format. No lectures. It's all a voyage of discovery. And I think for maybe 2 years, they managed to, this program managed to live. But it, in a sense, it wasn't, it was sort of doomed to failure because, I mean, you had to reach down into the high schools, which was logistically very, very hard. And again, you had tremendous resistance from, say, the German department. I mean, in a sense, you know, what's in it for the German department? Or for that matter, the French department? Or for that matter, really, the English department? In other words, you know, you had these people who were paid to teach German, paid to teach French, and here suddenly huge numbers of students were being sidetracked or taken away from them. And, you know, you had the much more important question, I think, that I feel these guys never really came to grips with, which was, now, Hutchins takes office in 29, so we're really, and he lasts there, I think, for 13 or 14 years. I don't have these facts in front of me, but what we, you know, of all things, of course, you know, the first atomic chain reaction happened at the University of Chicago while Hutchins was president. So this was a great scientific university as well. But I feel in my gut that Hutchins and Adler never really looked in the eye, the way modern university presidents today have to look in the eye, what was going on in the hard sciences and how they were going to, you know, their whole thing to this day at St. John's is, you know, well, we're going to teach the Ptolemaic universe, we're going to teach Kepler, we're going to teach Copernicus, we're going to teach Newton, so the boys and girls will see the grand march of science up through the calculus, et cetera, et cetera. But, and, you know, I was at St. John's, we did a, they're reading a little bit of Ernest Rutherford, an early 20th century scientist, I believe. But they never, they would never bite the bullet, you know, and look and say, well, now suppose this boy or girl wants to become a scientist. In a sense, when do we take responsibility for teaching him or her chemistry, physics? You know, and I don't know. I'm disturbed. Is it wrong to have freshman physics or freshman bio? I mean, I don't know. Anyway, my answer is probably not. Their answer is it can wait till junior year. You know, it's more important that a doctor have read Hippocrates and Galen. And this, and I, that's a powerful argument. That would be very interesting. I mean, I think a lot of doctors wish they had read Hippocrates and Galen and Fleming and a few other physicians whose works are in the great books. But in a way, you know, Hutchins and Adler were kind of superimposing a discipline on people's college ambitions that was possibly, arguably, unrealistic.
So what happened at that point, I guess, is that it fizzled out at Chicago, but got transferred to St. John's, and then in the other direction, it became a commercial program.
Yes. My book, curiously, is very interested in the commercial program. I'm less interested really in the philosophy of pedagogy, a lot, which has been written about quite a bit, and I must say it is not at all uninteresting. I mean, I was at a conference at Yale in October, and the president of Yale, the former president of the University of Chicago, and people from, you know, St. John's were and Harvard were all up on the stage, and these are genuinely live issues, although I don't know, I cannot write a book about the philosophy of education. So you're right. I mean, Adler was just again, there's no biography of Mortimer Adler, which is really almost unbelievable because it would be a real page-turner. Among other things, he's an incredibly greedy person, very interested in making a lot of money. And I think it was said sarcastically that Hutchins and Adler sort of invented the flying first class for the academics. They loved the good life. They loved money. And Adler had this idea of quite literally packaging and selling the great books to the masses. And he acted on this idea.
Before we get to that, how did the whole program get transferred to St. John's? Was St. John's already in existence, and did it take it over, or was it founded?
Yeah, that's actually a good question, Eric. That happened, I'm pretty sure, you know, in 37 or 38. And what happened, Hutchins at Chicago created something called the Committee on Liberal Arts, which was headed by Adler. It had McCune and had these two other guys whose names, regrettably, I haven't mentioned yet. One of them, almost unbelievable, Stringfellow Barr and Scott Buchanan, were really the posse, the key great bookies. And Hutchins brought them all in with some money from a rich lady named Stern, actually, to Chicago. And then within 2 years, they were kicked out. They were totally unwelcome. And for some reason, St. John's was a small failing college in Annapolis, Maryland. And they executed a contract for what was called the New Program. And the idea was that St. John's, of all things, actually repudiated all the debts of the pre-existing college, adopted this new program. Everybody on this so-called Committee for the Liberal Arts, well, certainly Barr and Buchanan immediately went to Annapolis. Buchanan became the president of St. John's. Barr became the head of the curriculum, and they tried to lure Adler, but they couldn't. He and Hutchins drifted off to various huge nonprofit institutions. Hutchins went to the Ford Foundation, which in turn bankrolled a sinecure for Adler. But Adler was all over St. John's, and that's how it was. Barr and Buchanan who sort of brought the fire to St. John's. They hoped to recruit Hutchins, who, within fairly short order, had left the University of Chicago. But he drifted off into sort of world peace activism, et cetera, et cetera. And Adler was a sort of a constant presence on the St. John's campus. And the so-called new program at St. John's, It's a hilarious name, because I guess we're at exactly 60 years since its founding. In fact, I guess they're about to celebrate their 60th anniversary, else they already have. Is that right? Now, maybe the 70th, if they were founded in 36. The new program, same as the old program. I mean, it's really quite incredible. They have not changed the course of study at St. John's College in 70 years.
That was Boston Globe columnist Alex Bean talking about the history of the Great Books Program. In this first half of the program, we concentrated on the academic history of the program. We'll be back in a short time to talk about the commercial development from the late 30s to the mid-60s. Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam returns now to talk about how the Great Books Program became a big commercial success in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s and raised a great deal of money for the University of Chicago.
Well, the thing about the Great Books is that they come to Chicago sort of as a teaching theory, as a kind of radical approach to despecializing the university, and is a very aggressive challenge on the part of Hutchins and Adler and the largest and most important university in the middle of the United States to kind of show everybody else how the liberal arts should be taught, to make a very dramatic statement that other universities have been going in the wrong direction, balkanizing themselves into narrow departments, and that boys and girls are being forced to specialize in tiny little fields and are emerging fundamentally uneducated after 4 years of college or university. What happens was in Chicago, they're pushing the Great Books very, very aggressively. Indeed, Hutchins, for somewhat separate reasons, was having some problems with the fat cats in Chicago, the megalo wealthy men who dominated the center of the city, the
the Swifts, the Marshall Fields, and so on. And he wanted really to get business support behind the university, which was still only 30 or 40 years old. And he started teaching the great books of all things. It was called the Fat Men's Seminar. He and Adler would go downtown to the University Club in downtown Chicago, and they invited, indeed, Marshall Field III, Swift, who was the chairman of the Board of Trustees of the University of Chicago. Anyway, they would sit down, about 13 or 14 businessmen, and preach the great books to them. And this had a lot of impact. I mean, among other things, one of the business people who took that course was the guy who later founded the Aspen Institute, a guy named Walter Pepke. But that's not really on message here. There was another fellow who kind of walks in at this time, a guy named William Benton, who was extremely young, still only in his early 30s, had known Hutchins at Yale Law School, and had left Yale Law School to start what is really widely acknowledged to be America's first modern advertising agency, which was quite famous at one time. It was called Benton and Bowles. And they came up with the idea, for instance, of jingles on the radio. They came up really with the idea of things that now sound very common to us, selling the sizzle, not the steak. They literally did that with Colgate toothpaste. They started selling, and again, this sounds second hat to us, but they were considered geniuses for selling the fact that you smelled better, your mouth smelled better, your mouth felt fresher after you brushed with Colgate, whereas toothpaste before just been sold on the kind of purported basis that they'll get your teeth cleaner. Anyway, Benton was extremely rich, and was something really of an advertising genius. I think he and an entrepreneur, and I think he'd be acknowledged as an advertising genius in any era. And Hutchins brought him to the University of Chicago, partly to reach out to the so-called fat men. And there was a specific incident, red baiting was just starting, pre-McCarthyist red baiting, and there was a suggestion that the University of Chicago was a little bit too red. Anyway, so he brought Benton in to kind of make peace with the downtown magnates. And Benton took the course, and Benton was this kind of Eureka-type fellow, and he said, well, I'm enjoying this course, Plato, Aristotle, this and that, but it's really hard to find these books. And Benton's this natural businessman, and he says, why don't we get in the business of creating and selling these books? There's no point really in creating them, because something like, say, Tristram Shandy, a 17th century novel, I mean, it already existed. Shakespeare already existed. But Benton said, and I should add, because the Great Books discussion groups, the whole notion of Great Books was being so aggressively propagandized by Chicago and by Hutchins that other so-called Great Books discussion groups were starting up. And to get a little bit ahead of ourselves, there were actually 40,000 such groups by the late 1940s. And so Benton had this kind of entrepreneurial idea. And I have to even open a tiny parenthesis. Benton was such an incredible entrepreneur that he had wandered off and bought the Encyclopedia Britannica from the general who ran Sears Roebuck, and I'm blanking on this guy's name. But Sears Roebuck, of course, was based in Chicago, as was Montgomery Ward. These were, of course, the greatest retail empires of mid-century America. I hardly know what to compare them to, since Walmart's almost like a drop in the bucket, really, relatively speaking. And I think it was General Wood was the head of Sears Roebuck, and somehow had acquired the Encyclopedia Britannica and wanted to get rid of it. And Benton said, well, I'll buy it. And he went to the trustees of the University of Chicago and said, why don't we buy the Britannica? And they rebuffed him. So he bought it on his own account with his own money and essentially donated it to the university. But what this gave him was a publishing vehicle and also a sales force for his kind of dream, his vision of creating a commercial product called the Great Books. And in fact, I just swiveled a little bit in my chair and I just took a look at William Benton's commercial product. My eyesight is so bad, but I think there's 52 volumes from left to right. There was a sort of a competitive issue here. Colliers, the once famous publisher, had made a bundle of money selling the Harvard Classics, which were sold, you know, advertised in magazines like the Saturday Review, like Harper's, the old Harper's that people actually read. And Benton wanted to go them one better. And basically starting in the very late 1930s and during the war, Benton, Adler, and Hutchins gathered together a bunch of kind of very junior faculty members and intellectuals, probably the most famous of whom was Saul Bellow, worked on the great books in a capacity I'll explain in a second. And, you know, they got Mark Van Doren, the great Columbia poet, whom they had taught, of course, the General Honor Seminar with back at Columbia. They got McCune, whom we mentioned, also from Columbia. They drafted this guy, Stringfellow Barr, and Buchanan, with whom they had taught at the People's Institute, taught the great books at the People's Institute in New York. And they have what is hilarious, of course, is then they had to decide which were the great books of the Western world. And I mean, I have all these memos, and to me, they're just straight comedy. And in fact, this was one of the reasons I was drawn to this subject. I mean, because you have these people, you know, campaigning against Molière, by the way, who was eventually dropped. I mean, almost inexplicably, but people would campaign against Molière, against Milton. In other words, it was absurd because I mean, intelligent people have taste. So you have these six or seven very well-read men, and all kind of arguing, well, Spinoza's not a great writer, blah, blah, blah. And in the middle of this, and I always sort of visualize this as a sort of Phaedo-esque farce or a drawing room comedy, a very elegantly written drawing room comedy. In the middle was Hutchins, who was sort of hilarious, and I have endless letters from Hutchins, who makes these sort of sardonic comments. It's really never very clear if he's read any of the books, frankly. Although, of course, the whole idea comes from his gut feeling that he was uneducated. But he takes some of these books on vacation and tries to get through them, and his taste is very much front and center. And now I'm going to go off on a minor tangent that these guys dreamed up, which was, you know, the Harvard classics were out there, and they knew they could create by using the Britannica presses and the beautiful Britannica bindings. They knew they could create a beautiful product of the 50, 52-odd volumes, the great books. But Benton, again, was a sales genius, and he said, well, you know, what can we do that will really hook the man and woman when we send the salesman through that front door? What's a great gimmick? Because all three of these people were intelligent enough to realize that it was somewhat unlikely that the people who bought the books were actually going to plow through them. So they Adler came up with this lunatic idea called an index to the great ideas, and then he dreamed up a fake word, the syntopicon, which sort of sounds Greek, sounds sort of authoritative, sounds like maybe you've heard of it. He had like seven or eight other possibilities, but he coined this neologism, the syntopicon, and he hired basically 30 grad students to go through all the great books and to create an index of the great ideas from A to Z. It's a two-volume index. And it's, I mean, much mocked. It's sort of utterly absurd. But the idea was that you could sort of sell this. I guess, you know, if like a 10th grader had to write a term paper on, materialism, say, well, we could go to the Syntopicon, look under M for materialism, and then there would be, say, like 40 citations in the great philosophers. To be honest with you, I assume materialism is more or less an 18th century notion. But in any case, there's a lot of materialist philosophy in the great books. So in other words, then it'd be like 40 sites of materialism, so someone could sort of get all the information they wanted that way. And one of the most famous quotes that ever came out of the great books was when Hadler spent actually $1 million creating the Syntopicon, which everybody thought was a huge waste of money. He handed the sort of the first Syntopicon to William Benton, and Benton opens it up under A. He says, well, if these are all the great ideas that begin with A, where's adultery? And then Adler said, oh, adultery's under marriage. But anyway, that's sort of the very beginning, and I'll the actual great books are launched at an astonishing banquet at the Waldorf Astoria in New York in 1952, the first set is earmarked for the Queen of England for some reason. The second set is later hand-delivered to President... I got to get this straight, because it couldn't have been 52, because Truman was in the White House, so it must have been 51.
He was still in until March of 53.
Say that again?
He was still in until March of 53.
Then maybe I have it right, because I keep thinking it's January of 52 was the banquet. Thank you. In any case, they hand-deliver the second set to Harry Truman, who I'm sure was like really, really eager to start reading. And again, by dint of Benton's astonishing gifts for promotion and salesmanship, it's probably one of the biggest cultural events of the immediate post-war era, that all these quote-unquote great geniuses have put their minds together. They've chosen what are called the great books of the Western world. And then, of course, they have to go out. They've got all this free publicity. They have to go out and sell them. And that becomes a tricky story. I mean, it's curious with the amazing publicity bump they had. That in the first 3 years, they sold only a few hundred copies. It was a complete disaster. The Britannica salespeople were supposed to be selling the great books, and for some reason they failed. In any case, they completely changed their sales strategy, and they got much more aggressive. And in fact, not once but three times, they were censured by the Federal Trade Commission for deceptive sales practices. But the fact is, deceptive sales practices work. So they would show up at people's doors. And this was, of course, people would knock. People would answer the doors if somebody knocked, and they'd say they disguised themselves as junior faculty from the University of Chicago, and they would do the whole thing, and it was sort of a trap for the unwary, I suppose. But in the great American tradition, and basically, if you signed, you only had to pay $10 then, and you'd get maybe 10 books for $10. It was very much the way the Book of the Month Club was hooking people in with first 10 books, $1, et cetera, et cetera. And they ended up, from probably the decade of the 50s, in the first 7 years, they sold 1 million sets for about $400 each, which was an astonishing windfall. And Benton was single-handedly responsible, because, really, he was very generous. It's kind of not a very... It's not a story of our time. It's sort of a story of another time. He, even though the university had not been willing to buy the Encyclopedia Britannica, he always felt that he owned it in trust for the university. And this initial windfall, which if you do the math was roughly a gross revenue of $400 million, produced $60 million in clear profit for the University of Chicago. Again, this is around 58, 59, 60, when that was a tremendous amount of money. And then basically it kind of ends. The bloom is really off the rose fairly quickly. And then there's a rather pathetic attempt to relaunch the great books of the Western world in 1992. But if we want, we could talk about, in a sense, why you have this bell curve, why they were so popular when they were and why they became so unpopular so quickly.
Why don't we?
Okay. I was just thinking about this yesterday, because I was talking to a friend of mine roughly my age whose parents did buy the great books when the salesman came by. And the fact is, if you think about these years, I don't know, you can call them what you will, the Eisenhower years or whatever. TV had not gained full purchase in the American home. And so there was room for other stuff. And, I mean, there's no point in being nostalgic about it, but you might as well be objective about it. So, people put other things in their living room. Obviously, the radio. Radio was incredibly an engrossing form of entertainment. But this era has been called by others, the high point of middlebrow. The Book of the Month Club got its start during this time. Encyclopedia sales were generally quite strong, and the great books were, a consummate consumable. Again, I look over my left shoulder, and I mean, what would I not give to have read these books? Although, I don't know what in heaven's name would convince me even to start reading them. They're incredibly forbidding. They're in a small type, double column on the page, as many people have remarked. I mean, it's ironical that once you open the book, it almost screams, "Don't read me." But as I look at them there, they have different colored bindings, and they're sitting on the shelf, and you see a name like Gibbon. And, you know, it sort of does trigger the consumption ethic. I mean, I'd really like to consume some Gibbon. I've actually read a little bit of Gibbon, but it reads much more easily in a paperback, you know, than in this ridiculous kind of sledgehammer that the University of Chicago created.
They also, I think, cut corners a little bit by taking translations that were in the public domain, and they weren't always the very best translations.
Yes, that's exactly right. There's a great deal of information about that in the archives, and I think I'm not going to end up writing about it. It's such a narrow, you know, Thomistic debate. But to be fair to them, yeah, they were extremely knowledgeable about translations, and there's a lot of back and forth about translations. And even, again, I can't go too far down this path, of course, because I'm completely ignorant. But even if you talk about Shakespeare, you know, things get tricky really quickly. I mean, sure, Shakespeare's in the public domain, but the Yale Shakespeare is an authoritative, somewhat authenticated, blah blah blah. You know, you start talking about the quartos, like they didn't pay for the Yale Shakespeare. You know, they didn't pay for the Loeb Shakespeare. So there are legitimate, important connoisseurs debates. And yeah, when you talk about foreign languages, of course, they did not commission, because they spent so much on the Syntopicon, it was a total waste of money, that there was no money left over to commission good translations. And at this time, as you know, also, you know, kind of less pretentious but totally worthy ventures like the Everyman's Library, which Bennett Cerf created, were coming forward. And they were commissioning translations, say, of Dostoevsky, and Tolstoy and others who are kind of, yeah, the Chicago guys kind of always went with the... I wish I could remember. I'm kind of embarrassed now. Even the Iliad and the Odyssey are kind of 18th century translations, which are sort of grand, but sort of also beside the point. It's not Lord Byron's translation, but I think it's Samuel Butler's translation. And I don't, with all due respect, you know, that's not what was going down in the 20th century. There were far better products to be had.
So they peaked in the early 60s. Then people realized that they were sort of white elephants?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, I think television just chased them out, frankly, because it was kind of perceived as a diversion. They even had a program, although Harvard had this first, where the idea was, you know, you'd spend 15 minutes a night reading the great works, and I guess after 2 or 3 years or something, you would have read all the great works of Western civilization. So it was deemed to be an activity. It was, you know, I was talking to this girl yesterday. Obviously, it was aspirational, and in a certain, I think, relatively small percentage of households, you know, parents would pull them off the shelf, saying, and you know, tell their children about John Donne and Paradise Lost. I mean, I don't think that was what was going down everywhere, but I think TV effectively, you know, chases out reading by the 60s, by the early 60s, certainly. And then in the middle to late 60s, you start getting a more, you know, the more serious intellectual assault on unreceived tradition, on the canon, on the university itself, and the notion of sitting around, you know, reading Gibbon is by 67 or 68 is completely ludicrous. I mean, we sort of made America
dead white males.
Exactly. that what's strange, I mean, it's hard to keep the timeline straight because the real, it's what's incredible is that, of course, Adler lived to be like 93 or 94, so Adler was alive really for everything, and Adler was alive to hear, I mean, they feel, the thinking is that the real culture, the sort of quote-unquote modern culture war sort of began at Stanford, I guess, in 87 or 88 when Jesse Jackson showed up on the Stanford campus saying, hey ho, Western Civ has got to go. There was a core course they were teaching at Stanford, and this was sort of regarded as the first attack of the barbarians, you know, outside the gates of Rome, and then that begat you know, Alan Bloom and the defense of the canon and the suggestion, I guess, that, you know, America was mired in a vast cultural illiteracy. But, I mean, the fact is, of course, from that moment on, the Western tradition was under almost continuous assault. I mean, curiously, I think there's a tiny bit of reaction at this point. But there is this odd footnote, this kind of really pathetic moment, and it's very hard for me to write about, but they made so much money, and then the books kind of fell off the cliff. But naturally, they had to keep thinking. You know, it's like Gilligan's Island. You know, can't we get that show back on the air? And so they kept having it for Adler's 75th birthday. They were going to relaunch the great books, and then they thought better of that. And then in 1992, basically, I guess, just to get some money. And to sort of capitalize on the debate about the canon, they invested a fair amount of money, and it's kind of sad and pathetic. I keep using those words, but I mean, again, I have all the memoranda and stuff, and it was just precisely the wrong time, you know, for Adler to try and get attention. He did not get very much, you know. He brought all his kind of old troopers, William F. Buckley, and few conservative academics to the Library of Congress, and you know, the irony, they you know, they wanted to drum up the same excitement they had drummed up at the Waldorf in 52. I guess it's exactly 40 years later, although I think it was 1990 and not 1992. And you know, the point was they hadn't really changed the canon at all. It was the same product. They kicked out, I don't know why I find this so amusing, but they kicked out Apollonius of Perga, who wrote a book called The Conics, which is actually a pretty famous book, I have since learned. You know, and they brought in four women. They brought in, because of course the original great books had no women whatsoever. They brought in George Eliot, Jane Austen, Virginia Woolf, and I don't know, maybe one of the Brontes, I don't know. And they put them all in one volume. So out of the 52 volumes, one volume had women in it. You know, in 1990, that just wasn't happening. It was just laughed. It just laughed out of court, if you will. And I mean, since then, I mean, that whole launch just died on the pad, so to speak, or you know, the rocket went back into the water. You can choose your ungainly metaphor, but I mean, really, this set of the great books, the famous University of Chicago Britannica set of the great books, really hasn't been heard from since.
That was Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam talking with us about the Great Books program, how it developed both academically and commercially between roughly 1938 and the mid-60s, and then its decline. I'm going to talk with Alex again maybe in June or July to see how the book is progressing and find out a little bit more about the sources he's gone to in writing it. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM, Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.